Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode is brought to you by Calm. Smartphones are remarkably helpful tools, although one thing I wouldn't call them is relaxing. But it turns out they can be, if you install Calm, the app that guides you into relaxation and helps manage stress and anxiety. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/candleland. And to be clear, that is calm.com/candleland. 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/candleland. This episode is brought to you by Douglas. When people say rest easy or sleep well, it sounds like the simplest thing in the world. But if you've ever tried to buy a mattress, you know that rest can be serious business. So cut out the middlemen, sleep well, and rest easy by ordering a Douglas from the comfort of your own home. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protector free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/candleland to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/candleland. Karen K. Ho, senior staff writer at Art News, one-time Pokemon Go correspondent for the Globe and Mail, and popularizer of the term doomscrolling, who once got under the skin of Bob Woodward by asking a very pointed question. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Thanks so much.
Today on the show, Jennifer Pan's Labyrinth, how a new Netflix documentary is exposing the rifts between journalism and true crime, which are not necessarily the same thing. And Umar Zamir, acquitted in the death of a Toronto police officer, turns out to have emphatically not been the cop killer that politicians and some media had suggested he was. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. This episode is brought to you by Amy Wood, Adrian Wells, Natalie Tremblay, Corey Porteous, Lindsay Short, Austin Lear, Kathy Kenzora, and Cameron.
My name's Cameron. I'm a tree planter living out in Percé, Quebec, and I support Candleland because your organization shines a light on stories the powers that be would rather you didn't think so hard about. Also, special honors to the Commons team. When I try to tell people about the darker side of our country, there's usually a Commons episode thrown in there somewhere to help get my point across. Keep going.
Submissions are open for our first ever short-form audio contest. We're looking for 3-minute audio pieces about local stories to be featured on one of our podcasts. Whether you're a journalist, audio producer, filmmaker, artist, storyteller, whatever, this is a great opportunity to get your work in front of a large audience. We want to hear the stories that you have to tell, so hit the link in the show notes to learn more or visit canadaland.com/audio contest.
Help me, please. I need help.
Calm down. What's going on?
I'm so broken and I heard shots. I don't know what's happening. I'm tied upstairs. Dad?
Hello?
I'm okay. I'm alive.
A woman is dead and her husband injured after a home invasion in Markham.
There was a knock at the door, then 3 gunmen burst inside.
They dragged me down the stairs and then I heard 2 pops.
We don't get a lot of homicides in Markham, so it's like a grenade going off.
Investigators are not ruling out any scenario, including the possibility the men broke into the wrong home.
We're only going to have one witness, and that is the daughter, Jennifer Pan.
In November 2010, Bikha and Hanpan were shot in what appeared to, at first, be a home invasion in Markham, Ontario, which is a city immediately north of Toronto. Bik died instantly while Han survived. Also surviving was their daughter Jennifer, who police in York Region soon discovered had arranged for a contract killing of at least one of them. 4 years later, Jennifer and a number of her co-accused were found guilty of the first-degree murder of her mother and the attempted murder of her father. Ontario's Court of Appeal later set aside the murder conviction and ordered a new trial, and Canada's Supreme Court is soon going to weigh in on that. The attempted murder conviction still stands. A feature in the July 2015 issue of Toronto Life magazine titled Jennifer Pan's Revenge brought renewed attention to the case. Published online in English and Mandarin, it became Toronto Life's most read story of the decade. And now a Netflix documentary called What Jennifer Did has brought the case to global attention, becoming a smash hit for the service, even by the scale of Netflix, netting an estimated 18 million views in just its first 5 days of release. It's also generated controversy for including supposed archival images of Jennifer that appear to have been AI-generated, but which one of the producers insists were real photos that were just ham-fistedly photoshopped to obscure their source. True crime docs are not generally my sort of thing at all, but I watched it Tuesday night and realized it was possible for a program to be compelling without being interesting, which is pretty much the Netflix mission statement these days. As an example, in the doc, a cop says of Pan's actions, "It's evil. It's as evil as it gets," which is compelling. But in the Toronto Life story, a friend of Pan's is quoted as saying, "I honestly don't think Jennifer is evil. This is just two people she hated." That's interesting. So, Karen, you wrote this Toronto Life story, but you also made a point of not watching the Netflix documentary on principle. And I love that you've maintained that. Could you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, first off, I don't own a TV, and I have a pretty intense full-time job that is not about true crime at all. Like, true crime is not part of my media diet in general. Like, I don't listen to podcasts. I don't watch other shows, with the rare exception of, like, true crime books that are written by friends, you know, like Sarah Weinman.
Yeah.
And so deviation from the norm, even for a case in which, to be clear, that I was approached about participating in and declined for a variety of different reasons, it is really just about time management and energy management. Because the thing about it is, right now, regardless of my lack of participation, I'm being written about in relation. Like, I have seen articles written about the case in relation to, like you said, its success to try and get that web traffic. And many of them mention me and the Toronto Life story, sometimes with errors, right? Like, I've seen one article that called it Toronto Sun instead, which we know is a very, very different publication.
Yeah.
But on principle, it's also just about the reviews I've seen are bad. So the metaphor I go back to is, like, I don't need to see a Cybertruck or ride a Cybertruck to know it's a bad vehicle.
Yeah.
And I don't need to watch the Jennifer Pan documentary to know that I would not personally enjoy it and that it wouldn't align with the things that I would prefer to spend my time and energy doing.
I really love that. I love how, because you've done quite a few media appearances around it, but I love that the fact that you haven't watched it for these reasons, I like how that actually foregrounds the question of what is the labor involved in doing media appearances like this, for what places pay or in many cases don't pay for appearances like this. Why would you invest, 90 minutes to watch it? I mean, I was relieved to discover it wasn't 4 hours. It was just 90 minutes, which by Netflix standards is tight.
And like I said, it's not related at all to my current job, which is very technical and intensive. And so on a practical basis, like, it just doesn't make sense for me to watch it. And then on top of that, I think it's incredibly frustrating. And I've expressed this about how my choice not to participate in the documentary has not absolved me of being held responsible for its content in terms of, like, the emotional labor and burden of its framing choices and its discussion in popular culture and in society. And to be clear, like, I have only done media interviews with the CBC and with you because of pre-existing relationships to, like, it made sense for me to do Metro Morning because it's reaching the very people in the community. I'm trying to be very, very careful, especially as an Asian woman, to be mindful of, like, the labor involved. I have done so many interviews in the last 4 years about things like mental health and about the search for knowledge and explanations for like incredibly tragic things, as you said in the intro regarding doom scrolling, that the novelty of being interviewed by like prestigious organizations has totally dissipated as well.
And one of the things that I think has come up is the distinction as a genre, as an industry, as a thing between true crime and journalism. I mean, your story foregrounded the character of Jennifer Pan, whereas the documentary is very much from the police perspective. It's done as a police procedural in a way that makes them seem very competent to have solved what was ultimately a fairly straightforward case. It kind of reminded me, have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon?
Yes.
It kind of reminded me a bit of like the last scene or the second last scene of that, in terms of like, here's this bit of mythologizing of, oh, look, the police solved a very easy case and isn't it great? And it is still satisfying to watch them do it, but very much putting that at the center of the story, of the procedural, of moving it away from the characters. Like, I remember when I read your story the first time when it came out, I found it deeply moving. I mean, in part because, I mean, you put some of yourself into it, which something I actually had forgotten until I reread it this morning, that you knew Jennifer in high school, you were friends with some of the people involved. But I found the story very compelling in that it was about exploring the social and psychological and even cultural context in which this might unfold, rather than trying to figure out, literally just trying to figure out, how do we catch the killers? I don't know, how much of a distinction do you think there is between these things that we see on Netflix, even if we don't actually watch them, but we know that Netflix is putting them out all the time, versus, you know, long-form journalism or things like what you wrote?
So I've seen true crime documentaries that are really good and nuanced, like HBO's adaptation of Last Call, which explored like a serial killer who targeted closeted gay men during the AIDS crisis, which was based on my friend Elon Green's book, like is incredibly nuanced and focuses much more on the context and like the systemic failures of police at the time, right? In terms of taking what was going on in the gay community super seriously. And it was incredibly sensitive because the people who did it did other award-nominated or awarding documentaries like Crip Camp, and you know, they did Short Bus, and so they had a vested interest in representing the queer community because they are actively part of it now, right? They understand like representation gets almost a footnote who the killer is. And then to your point, I really go back to the story, which is now more than 10 years old as well, which is J. Caspian Kang's reporting on the Oikos school shooting and the role that toxic masculinity in Korean culture. He, being Korean himself and speaking in Korean to the shooter in jail and just talking to the community and, you know, really talking about the wider issues. The most important thing that he highlighted, how his identity was a subject of expertise rather than a bias. And then he also talked about there is a level of humanity and empathy that is missing from when you focus on murder as entertainment or sensationalism. And the thing for me, the story of what happened with Jennifer was really like a statistical thing, because there are so many people I heard from and read about online that were like, I had a very similar upbringing to Jennifer. And, you know, like it was just like this particular thing that prevented me from carrying out violence against them.
You mean in a particular upbringing in the sense of, broadly speaking, immigrant parents who pushed their children to succeed to the point where it may be counterproductive in terms of their development?
So there's the overemphasis on personal effort and education to overcome systemic discrimination. And then the second thing that is not alluded to in the documentary is just like how many immigrant daughters, especially like East Asian daughters, grow up feeling like they are disappointments because they are not sons. I cannot emphasize that enough. Like the one child policy in China, right, was an exported idea. I cannot emphasize how growing up with that feeling, whether you are explicitly aware of it or not, can like poison a person from inside. No matter what you do, no matter what you achieve, you are a disappointment. I allude to it in my story because I understand it. If you're not even mentioning the son in the documentary, then you can't even have that conversation.
Yeah, no, until like I watching the documentary, I didn't realize that she had had any siblings. When I read your story, I was like, shit, did I miss that in the movie? That she has a brother named Felix. It's such a weird thing about, certainly documentary can be extraordinarily nuanced, medium at least as deep as any other. At the same time, when you're trying to tell a story in a particular way, which is to say with a particular degree of, I suppose, entertainment value, that almost always leads to a streamlining of storytelling for the purpose of, I guess, pacing.
I think a lot about how, for lack of a better term, when murder becomes entertainment, then representation is a real issue for especially like narrative nonfiction stories. I only feel confirmed about not participating because of everything that I've reported about how few stories are about Asians and Asian Canadians and Asian Americans are told by Asians and edited by Asians, if that makes sense.
Clearly, journalism as an industry is not in terms of quality, but in terms of economics is heading in a certain direction or is this on a certain trajectory, whereas not that true crime documentary or true crime stories are a new thing at all, but it certainly it is on a very different trajectory at the moment. I mean, the company that made what Jennifer did, Raw TV, it's a British company that basically churns these things out for Netflix. I mean, so many of these Netflix documentaries are actually specifically from this one company. There was a Hollywood Reporter story last year called From Gold Rush to the Tinder Swindler, How Raw Conquered the Doc World, which refers to them as Netflix's favorite creator. Water cooler moments of the darker WTF variety. Their first hit was like, yeah, Don't Fuck with Cats, which I just know is the one I've seen clips of the mispronouncing Etobicoke.
They were trying to take his picture outside his condo in Etobicoke, Canada. Etobicoke, that's interesting. Where is that? Etobicoke is a suburb outside of Toronto.
And there actually are right now, or just were in Toronto, shooting another one I asked to potentially be involved in, and then they did not ask me to be involved in it. So I'm not involved with. But I guess I'm wondering, as journalism is going in one direction, and whereas these true crime things that are in many ways, in most respects, reliant on journalism having been done going in another direction, what do you think this means? Where do you think this is headed? As there's less journalism and more true crime, and if that continues to both things continue to be the case, what does that mean 5 years from now?
I've already seen media companies take away option rights from writers. Like, it's an open secret that, like, if you write anything for ESPN, Disney owns the option rights. Because why wouldn't they? They have a huge entertainment division. And I wouldn't be surprised. I would have to check this. But, like, Condé Nast has an entertainment division. So I wouldn't be surprised if you wrote a viral article for any of their properties. It wouldn't belong to the writer anymore. It would belong to Condé Nast Entertainment for the potential to option it for further adaptation into like a TV show or movie. But the thing that it does, the labor involved and the economics of reporting these true crime stories is just like so bad. The sheer economics of it are, I had to work nights and weekends with two other full-time jobs, one of which I wrote about for Canadaland, right? Like about the working at BNN.
Oh yeah, the Rebel, yeah.
For $15 an hour. And so I would do reporting on that at nights and weekends, or like when I worked in Yellowknife at Northern News Services, I would do this on nights and weekends, like drafts and edits and stuff like that. And so the thing about it is, to your point, really good reporting on the ground. It feels like true crime is constantly mining for stories because the economics of doing the day-to-day reporting is not the lucrative thing to do, to your point. The lucrative thing is to get the most sensationalist parts and turn it into a documentary film that glosses over the messier parts. And I'm very proud of what I collected. And, you know, there are things that, because I was like Facebook friends with Jennifer, right, that have never been published or whatnot. But at the same time, it's like, the whole point of being a reporter is not thinking about what's going to be the most sensational. But like, I think going back to the labor thing, it's really just about what society prioritizes and what these entertainment companies prioritize. Because Raw only exists because they keep getting these contracts from Netflix, right? And they keep shooting up to number one. Popularity does not necessarily indicate quality. Everybody's fascinated by a car crash. Mm-hmm. It's not a good thing for society that there are more car crashes.
This episode is brought to you by Calm. When it comes time to relax, what do you do? It should be so easy. Just relax, right? But even late at night, I often find myself doom-scrolling on my screen, which by definition is far from relaxing. Doom-scrolling is a very modern problem, but thankfully, Calm offers a very modern solution. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, and uses the technology you already carry with you to help you to actually relax. Stress, anxiety, rumination, these are things many of us deal with, and Calm offers a comprehensive mindfulness toolkit to help soothe your mind and build better habits. Since relaxation is deeply personal, Calm tailors the experience to your individual tastes. There's meditation, breathing exercises, sleep stories, and peaceful music. Whether you're looking to meditate, sleep better, or simply refrain from the doom, Calm is the balm for the gloomy modern world. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/CanadaLand. Go to calm.com/CanadaLand for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. AI, we've all seen the bad stuff it can do, malformed hands and feet, ChatGPT insisting it knows better than you, swarms of bots, though thankfully they're not super intelligent bots, not yet. But what is AI actually good for, and how can it help you? Well, for one, it can help you make a killer website. Squarespace was already the best all-in-one web solution with beautiful, easy-to-use templates and a ton of features already built in, like an online store, analytics, email marketing. In the past, I was able to help someone whip up a Squarespace website really quickly and easily. But the latest development over at Squarespace HQ is making things even easier. It's called Squarespace Blueprint, and it's a guided design system that uses AI to help you build a custom website in record time and automatically optimizes it for search engines so that people can actually find it. And when people do find your site, having flexible payment options built in means it's never been easier to run a business online. And, you know, really it's hard to run a business without being online these days. So if you want to enhance your online footprint and get AI working for you to make things that are beautiful and decidedly not malformed, check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/CanadaLand to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/CanadaLand. So in this show, Karen, we'd like to duly note things. Today, I would like to note duly that, as listeners may remember, in late summer 2021, CanadaLand released a 5-part podcast series called The White Saviors, which looked at WeCharity and its founders, Craig and Mark Kielberger, tracing the history of the organization from its earliest days in the mid-1990s through the events that led to the abrupt winding down of its Canadian operations 25 years later. As some of you may also know, Teresa Kielberger, the mother of Craig and Mark, launched a lawsuit against CanadaLand in October of 2021 relating to certain statements in the show's first episode. In addition to CanadaLand, the company, the suit named several people who were credited on the episode and or worked at CanadaLand, including myself, as well as Isabel Vincent, a reporter who was among the interviewees. What fewer of you likely know is that last fall, the CanadaLand defendants and Isabel Vincent filed parallel motions to dismiss the lawsuit pursuant to Section 137.1 of the Courts of Justice Act, commonly called the SLAP or anti-SLAP provisions, which are intended to, quote, discourage the use of litigation as a means of unduly limiting expression on matters of public interest, end quote. As is to be expected, Teresa Kielberger opposes the motions, asserting that they have no merit. I'd like to duly note that the matter was heard in court on Tuesday at the very lovely Osgoode Hall, where our respective lawyers delivered oral arguments before Superior Court Justice Edward Morgan. At the end, Justice Morgan said he doesn't have a long queue of reserves, meaning that there aren't too many matters he has to get to before this one, and so he hopes to rule on it fairly soon. So I just like to duly note that this motion was in court, and there will be a decision on it soon, and also that Osgoode Hall has perhaps the most remarkable interiors of any public building in Toronto, and that if you live in the city and have never done so, you should probably just pop in one day to walk around.
Duly noted.
Karen, what would you like to note duly today?
I'd like to note the work of Connie Walker and her amazing podcast, Stolen, which recently had its third season debut.
Oh, wow. Where did it end up being picked up?
So it hasn't been picked up. That's the problem.
Ah.
Gimlet is obligated to release its latest season, and they are searching desperately for a new home, despite the fact that it has won, you know, every prestigious award that you can think of.
Yeah, well, she won the Pulitzer and the Peabody within days of each other last year. And yeah, she was just on the Time 100 Most Influential People list. That's extraordinary. And yet, yeah, she was laid off from Gimlet recently, wasn't she?
She was. And then another thing that really strikes me is that despite all this growing attention on her work and how it serves as a really good counterexample to true crime, right, in terms of its nuance, in terms of how it talks about systemic issues, both in Canada and the United States, regarding like what caused, you know, I think a lot of this mistreatment and devastation in Indigenous communities, both not just among missing and murdered Indigenous women, but also the men in those communities that were put in residential school. There has never been a public apology from the CBC in regards to how they treated her, right? Like there was an amazing profile earlier this year in The Walrus that was almost like New Yorker style in terms of how comprehensively it chronicled her career. And it details like the way that she was treated at the CBC. And like, I really think it's an amazing illustration of like how brain drain happens in Canadian media, like what pushes really brilliant people to leave the country and its ecosystem or places like the CBC to leave journalism or to leave the country. And then, you know, in terms of the lack of accountability.
Yeah. And while she was back in Canada last September, we actually recorded an interview with her about all of that. And we'll link to it in the show notes.
The people who did that to Connie Walker, a future award-winning podcaster and broadcaster and journalist in general. Like, I grew up watching her on Street Sense. I remember this.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I'd be curious, like, if there was public editor or someone internally tried to do this. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things that I think about all the time.
I'd be curious if there was a private apology. I mean, I don't know if it's a private apology. I guess it's not necessarily my business to know. But I mean, even setting aside from the public apology, I wonder if anyone has apologized to her privately.
Well, even if it was private. So the thing about it is, if there was a private apology, then I think it's more harmful. Because the problem is, like, it's the public broadcaster. And then on top of that, it's almost like the burden is on Connie to know that there was internal admission of fault, but there would be never public admission, right? Like it would be more meaningful if it was public, because then there would be an impetus for them to like improve and treat their staff differently going forward, like in a similar case. If the concern is that like someone in a similar position will use it for like salary negotiations or promotion negotiations going forward, then that's also antithetical to all of the organization's promises to do better on diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I think fundamentally the thing about it is that show is such a beacon of excellence. And like I said, like an example of true crime, its evolution and its inclusion, but there aren't resources in our media and entertainment system.
Yeah, not even for the most decorated awards-wise podcaster of, I wouldn't say of our time, but like of presently, one of the very few people to win a Pulitzer for podcasting. I think only the second. Duly noted.
Police in Toronto are also coming under increasing scrutiny after the high-profile acquittal of a man charged with murder.
Criticism is swirling around whether the case should even have made it that far.
The judge highlighted potential collusion among the officers who all had the same wrong story.
We believe this was an intentional and deliberate act.
Don't say things that aren't balanced, that potentially sway public opinion.
The judge apologized to Zamir, some suggesting a special prosecutor could have provided some objectivity in a highly politicized case. Even the premier had tweeted his outrage that Zamir got bail in 2021.
As politicians, as people who are elected to represent the people, we do not wade into the courts.
The people I blame the most are the politicians who knew better, who sounded off about this case.
On the morning of July 2nd, 2021, the Toronto Police put out a statement from the chief or the interim chief at the time about the death of one of their officers. As it explained it, Constable Northrup was killed while responding to a call downtown in the very early hours of this morning. Our preliminary information is that he and his partner were conducting an investigation in response to a priority call in an underground parking lot here at Queen and Bay. During the course of this dynamic event, Constable Northrup was struck by a vehicle. We believe this was an intentional, deliberate act. That was followed up later in the afternoon by them putting out a press release announcing that a 31-year-old man, Umar Zamir, had been charged with first-degree murder. That led to the sort of predictable, you know, the kind of responses you expect in certain parts of the media when a police officer dies or is killed in the line of duty, with the Toronto Sun taking political shots, such as like a few days later, pointing on the cover saying, like, PM silent on cop slaying, which raises the question, can you say someone has been slain? Is it the same as killed or closer to murder? Or Rosie DiMano in The Star writing about it and then saying, you know, throughout the city's history, it has been mercifully rare that a Toronto police officer has been murdered. The last time was in 2011 when Richard Catchcar, from behind the wheel of a stolen snowplow, ran at Sergeant Ryan Russell on Avenue Road, which is all correct, but it very much implies that this was murder, and certainly the police had alleged this was murder, and certainly the guy was charged with murder. And so a few months later, when Umar Zamir was released on bail, there was an uproar from not just the media quarters, but from politicians, which is not the sort of thing that often happens in Canada around specific cases. In a series of what were at the time still called tweets, Premier Doug Ford wrote, "This is beyond comprehension. It's completely unacceptable that the person responsible for this heinous crime is now out on bail. Our justice system needs to get its act together and start putting victims and their families ahead of criminals." Patrick Brown, who is the mayor of Brampton, Ontario, wrote, "This is disgusting. It is very disturbing that the person charged with this heinous crime is now out on bail." And Toronto Mayor John Tory said, "Our city continues to mourn the death of this Constable Northrup. It is almost impossible to imagine a circumstance in which an accused in a case of first-degree murder would be granted bail," which is somewhat surprising. He was a lawyer. I don't believe he practiced criminal law. So it was interesting to have those three, who also coincidentally, all of them were three successive leaders of the Ontario Progressive Conservative Party, weigh in on this. Whereas what I found was actually the media was a little bit more circumspect, because the way it works in Canada is that, generally speaking, the details of a bail hearing are under a publication ban. That is to say, in order to keep potential jurors from, you know, learning details of the case that may not be presented to them in court, the reasons a person is or is not released on bail are generally not information that can be published. It is, however, perhaps paradoxically public information, is that anyone can go into the courthouse and find out, but they just can't broadcast it or publish it to anyone else. So what happened this week is, after he was acquitted, the trial ended, the publication ban lifted, and we got a lot greater insight into the weakness of the police case for murder. What it seemed to be was very much a deeply unfortunate situation in which plainclothes officers had approached him and his family, and he didn't realize they were plainclothes officers. He thought they were being mugged in the City Hall parking garage, and then he backed up and knocked the person over and then ran him over while trying to escape. At worst, you would think that would be manslaughter, but it was very different, and certainly the way it had been portrayed, and to the point where the judge actually issued an apology to Zamir after he was acquitted. All of which to say, it feels like a really clear example of how police are able to define a narrative up front, and how, which I guess we know about, but also how publication bans, which are theoretically supposed to be exist to protect the accused, can in fact work against their interest. Have you followed this case at all?
I've read a little bit about it, especially in preparation for this conversation. The thing about it is there was so much at play in this story in terms of like the demographics of police, like in the Ontario Provincial Police, as well as in Toronto, the demographics of the people who spoke out. People don't like bail for the people they don't like, right? Like bail conditions exist for a reason. The whole premise of like innocent until proven guilty, except for this guy who's brown, is like a common narrative, right? And the thing that I go back to in regards to comments made by these politicians is precedent. What were their comments or lack thereof for similar cases, right? Like in terms of like, because like you said, the rarity of police being killed in Canada is correct. But the thing about it is the incentives for especially conservative politicians and conservative columnists or conservative newspapers is the support of police officers, plainly. Like in votes, in endorsements, in advertising, as sources, right? Like that is something that we need to talk about in terms of this is like the cooperation or the scoops. And like I said, getting quotes back versus having to file records requests for police misconduct. And the thing about it is propaganda is incredibly effective at countering what is increasing amounts of reporting regarding police misconduct at a variety of different areas, right? Like whether it be domestic violence, whether it be about who gets stopped and frisked. I still think about Desmond Cole's story of his experience being a Black person in Toronto and how many times I have seen him framed as an activist. And the people who are pro-police are never framed as activists, conversely, you know, pro-police activists or whatnot. But I think fundamentally, politicians who make these public statements, like they would stop making those statements if enough people complained, right? And called their offices and said, like, we're not going to vote for you again in the next election for doing this. And unfortunately, the people who, based on the demographics of the last election, right, the people who are voting for them are in support of what they're saying. It's like a weird type of pandering.
Yeah.
It's just like when they show up to those Diwali events or like, mm-hmm. you know, like Chinese community events. Until there are political consequences for doing so, this is only going to happen more. Because the police union is so incredibly powerful, mm-hmm. especially in Toronto and Ontario, I'm sure, like you said, behind the scenes, there were lots of conversations oh, yeah. or texts and stuff about, thank you for making that public statement.
Oh, very likely.
And then the other thing is, I'm grateful that the judge was so clear in their decision and explanation for why, because then it makes it harder for the propaganda machine to fight that. The real question is, what will happen now as a result of that decision? Because that person's life has been ruined. Like, I would not be surprised if they move and their family move.
Yeah. I mean, there will probably be some people who never accept that he is not guilty. But there is talk of some potential inquiries into just what happened here. Why was a special prosecutor not brought in, for example? Why were these charges pursued in the face of what appears to have been such a weak case? Did the officers who were witnesses collude on their statements, since they all seemed to have a consistent – between them, there was a consistent recounting of what happened that apparently did not match up with what the details in the video footage showed. And, you know, John Tory himself has at least, you know, not that he's in power, has much power anymore, but he's walked it back. And the Star did get in a very nice dig where he said – where basically Tory says, well, it's on the court system to make, you know, better – make more information available to better understand his processes so that, you know, when we're facing media and public pressure to comment, we have something informed to say. And he's not wrong that the courts – I think there is definitely – I think he's actually right that there is more room for the courts to have to do – should or ought to do more to be maybe less defaulting to secrecy where it's counterproductive for the accused. But as the Star's article, I think it was written by Jacques Allon, followed Tory's comment with a full paragraph in parentheses that says, like, well, yeah, it's under publication ban, but that wouldn't stop the mayor or anyone on his staff from just walking over to the courthouse. And the courthouse was like next door, literally next door to City Hall, just going there and looking at the reasons to inform themselves of it. It's sort of like this prioritization of narrative over facts and information.
The plainest facts are the judge highlighted that the story matched too much among the officers, right? Like I said, the optics are who gets granted bail and who doesn't. It should not depend on their ethnicity and the accusation of who they killed. And like I said, the framing is, oh, they're only charged with this because columnists and politicians said so. Judges don't write decisions like that without a lot of careful thought. And so the thing about it is they can be upset. As reporters, like the whole point is like to be skeptical. But if these columnists, especially the conservative ones, are heavily reliant on police as sources, is that incentivizes them to be in favor and supportive of the police.
That's Shortcuts this week. Thank you so much for joining me, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
People can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com, where they can complain about how fast I speak, or they can follow me on Blue Sky. Karen, where can people find you?
They can find me also on Blue Sky. I am on Instagram. It's mostly pictures of my dog, Max, as well as they can read my reporting at artnews.com.
Cool. And Karen, I understand you're donating the honorarium associated with this Shortcuts.
Sure. I have chosen Nana Abba Duncan, who's the Carty Chair in Journalism, Diversity, and Inclusion at Carleton University, has started the Mary Ann Chad Carey Center for Journalism and Belonging.
Oh, wow.
And she was the first Black woman newspaper publisher in North America and the first woman publisher in Canada. And so she has a fellowship specially for Black journalists to go to the National Association of Black Journalists Convention and Career Fair in Chicago. And having been a Canadian journalist trying to attend American conferences, the expense, especially with the exchange rate, is something I'm hyper aware of. And I know firsthand how much of a difference it can feel for your career to go to those American networking events and like meet other people in the industry that can relate to a lot of your own experiences. And so that's where I'm donating.
That's wonderful. Reminder, submissions are open for our first ever short form audio contest. We're looking for 3-minute audio pieces about local stories to be featured on one of our podcasts. Hit the link in the show notes to learn more or visit canadaland.com/audio contest. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. The music is by So-Called, syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you value this podcast, please support us. We rely on listeners like you paying for journalism, and as a supporter, you'll get premium access to all of our shows ad-free, including early releases and bonus content. Including, you'll get to hear me and Karen talking about Cher, I think, on a recent piece of bonus content. You'll also get our exclusive newsletter, discounts on Canadaland merch, invites and tickets to our live and virtual events, and more than anything, you'll be a part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis, and you'll be keeping our work free and accessible to everybody. Come join us now, click the link in your show notes, or go to canadaland.com/join. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.